cases scheduled for oral argument, and two cases which have been submitted on the record. The purpose of where the record will state the ones which were submitted. First one is 2007-3085, Webb versus FBOP. Second one is 207-3317, Dickerson versus the BVA, the Veterans Administration. The first case we will hear an oral argument is 2007-1272, plus 800 ADEPT versus Murax Securities. Mr. Lee, you reserve 3 minutes for your rebuttal time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. You can begin.
To please the court, my name is William Lee, and together with my partner, Lisa Carrizolo, I represent the appellants, Target, and West. This morning, time permitting, I'd like to briefly address four issues and leave the remainder of the issues to the briefs. First, I would like to address the claim construction of the term assignment, a limitation that is in all of the asserted claims of the other patents. A limitation that we contend requires that assignments be made before a phone call is placed, and a limitation, if properly construed, which would exclude the target's services and products from a finding of infringement. Second, the second issue I'd like to address is the jury award of approximately $9 million, which is based upon revenues from products which were not accused of infringing, and for which there was no factual predicate for application of the entire market value rule. Third, I will briefly address the district court's refusal or declination to enter judgment as a matter of law on the tortious interference claim, and to consider the issue of whether that claim was preempted by federal law. And fourth, and very only briefly, if time permits, I'd like to address the unasserted claims of the Moore Schaefer patents, approximately 167 of them, which were invalidated as a result of an argument made in closing.
Mr. Lee, there are a lot of connections in this case. I'm not sure I have them all straight. But let me ask right off the bat, if you succeed on your first point, what is left of your second, third, or fourth point?
Your Honor, if we succeed on our first point, it will address the second point, which is damages. I would also suggest that it has implications for the third point, the tortious interference claim, because a substantial portion of the evidence, and particularly the argument made at trial, was here is the Neville patents. They cover real time. Here are the Moore Schaefer patents. Moore Schaefer should have known they covered real time. They therefore should have known they were invalid. Therefore, the commencement of litigation under the Moore Schaefer patents was objectively baseless, and there's no preemption of federal law. They are related. The last issue is independent, more so from the first three, and simply goes to the question of when, as a result of the pretrial and trial proceedings, parties have focused on three claims of two patents, can a jury be asked with no evidence to adjudicate the validity of approximately 165 other claims?
I thought the last one was also related to the first in the sense that the invalidity arguments that you're making depend to some extent on prevailing on the claim construction with respect to the metal patent. You're saying that the invalidity judgment can't stand if you're constructing the metal patents.
That's correct, Your Honor. To be more precise about it, the last argument was going to focus only on the unasserted claims. And the argument that I was going to focus on is, in fact, the procedural argument of whether, absent proof, the jury could properly render a verdict on those claims. There is, as to the three claims that were actually adjudicated and found to be invalid, that they are for sure, and we have briefed it on that basis, related to the question of whether assigning was properly interpreted. So it does follow through all the way.
Since we've digressed a little bit, I won't ask you to digress further, but before you sit down, we also need to talk about what the effect of the willfulness issue would be, depending on how the first issue gets turned.
And Your Honor, let me do this. I'll turn to the first issue, but to frame it in terms of the willfulness issue, this is a case in which the jury verdict was rendered in October of 2006. The decision on the JML motions was rendered in April of 2007. Seagate and its objectively reckless standard was decided and the opinion issued in August 2007. The claim construction issue I will now address is one that I think we would suggest would have required under Seagate, if it had been decided, a determination of no objective recklessness. And let me say why. The claim interpretation that I'm going to address in just a few minutes is one that...
If we let you.
That I'll try to address in a few minutes, is one which, in fact, the parties appeared to agree upon, the court appeared to agree upon, and it didn't change until the 19th day of trial.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Pardon?
Nothing wrong with that.
Right? Well, Your Honor, in a purely analytical framework, this court has made it clear that the court can change claim constructions at any time up until the time of the jury charge. I think an issue, and it's not one that we have briefed here, but an issue that the court may consider in other cases, at some point in time, the proceedings are so far down the road that there is prejudice that results at the moment in time when the claim changes. But if we accept the proposition that the claim interpretation can claim any change at any point up until the time of the jury charge, it still leaves the question, to go to Senior Judge Plager's question, of whether you could be objectively reckless under Seagate if there was a claim interpretation for the first and 18 days of trial which would have resulted in a finding of non-infringement. And that claim interpretation is the issue of assigning. Assigning is in all...
On the claim construction, you misquoted claim 29.
I have claim 29 here, Your Honor.
On page 23, it's not accurate.
Well, why don't we go? I'll go to claim 29 in the appendix at 8414 at column 15 and look at the claim itself. Because I think it's accurately quoted at all of the key areas. So at column 15, line 26, Your Honor, there is all potential first parties. At column 15, line 33, there is assigning to the physical location of said potential first parties a telephone number of a service location of a second party that will receive calls.
Okay, your problem with the claim construction is the cell phone calls. It strikes me that you're this problem.
And Your Honor, I think I have these answers to those unassertive claims. The first thing is the fact that there are cell phone claims doesn't make the claims, doesn't change what the claims say on their face.
And it's clear, isn't it, that the specification contemplates that with respect to cell phones, that the determination of the physical location of the cell phone will be made after the call is placed.
I don't think so, Your Honor. Let me explain why. There is nothing, it's important to go back in time to the filing date of this patent, which is 1992. It's very early in the technology. Second point, Your Honor, is there is nothing that would preclude the claim as properly construed by our mark to cell phones. A cell phone has an area code. It has seven other numbers. Generally, particularly back in 1992 and in the 1990s, it was issued from a location that had something to do with the area code. You could assign a physical location to that just as was required by the claim.
You mean the billing address?
The billing address or the location. If you get one today, you could have a 2 in New York, you could have a 212 or a 646. But it's a pretty darn good indication that the cell phone was purchased by someone who lived in that area code.
But the cell phone is not necessarily in that particular location.
It's not, Your Honor, but if you look at the only two portions, let me back up just a little bit. You can take the claim as properly construed and give all of the words meaning. potential, all potential, that will receive assignment. All of those words are the words we focus on in Claim 29. And have them applied to someone who purchases his cell phone at a particular location.
Well, but your problem is that the specification, if you look at column 6, clearly is contemplating that the location of cell phones would be determined by their actual physical location on the call, right?
Yeah, I think there are three answers to that, Your Honor.
But that is my description of the specification is correct, right?
I think, Your Honor, if I focus on what you say is contemplating, the answer is yes. Is it enabling? No. And in fact, if you look at column 6, line 59, column 7, line 3, there are only two portions of the specification that deal with cell phones. The first is at column 3, line 6 to 12. And what it says is, it might apply or could apply to cellular devices if there are future technological advances. Then you get to column 6, line 59, which is the only other place. And what it says is, there may be developments in the future that would allow you to do it with cell phones. And then, critically, I would suggest, if you go to line 66, in the event long distance carriers can accommodate the ANI and latitude and longitude concurrently, this invention can be employed. So that's why I answered the question, I hope correctly. When you say contemplate, yes. Enable, no.
Well, what difference does enablement have to do with claims?
It has this to do, Your Honor, because we're focusing on claims, three claims that were not asserted. And the claim is that you should consider those three claims and consider them as broadly as construed by 800 ADEPT, and they should illuminate the manner in which claims such as claim 29 should be interpreted. The fact that those claims are susceptible of an interpretation that's consistent with ones we offer, which is you assign it a physical location, and that's the physical location, doesn't render the claims inoperative. But if we're wrong, and if the claim would be rendered inoperative, that should, I would suggest, illuminate the claim construction inquiry. If you have unasserted claims that are inoperative or not enabled, should the court use those unasserted claims, inoperative and unenabled, to give a greater breadth to a claim which on its face has a narrow interpretation? And, Your Honor, I think one of the best ways to get at this is this. If the court considers what you define as intrinsic evidence, the claim terms, the specification, and the file history, under 800 ADEPT's claim interpretation, the words, all potential, that will receive, can be eliminated from the claim. If you take claim 29 and you just take those words out, it has the same meaning. If you leave them in and you read columns 1 and 2 of the specification, and then the five steps that are columns 5 and 6 of the specification, those words, all potential, that will receive, make good sense. This is particularly important, I would suggest, because this is a prosecution where the term all potential first parties was added at the end of a very long prosecution.
Well, there was no discussion of the cell phone claims in this prosecution.
There was no discussion of the cell phone claims, so I think, Your Honor,
so why can't we read the prosecution as directed to the landlines?
Well,
and not the cell phone.
Well, Your Honor, then the question becomes, what does claim 1, claim 29, for instance, cover? Does it cover just landlines, or does it cover more broadly, cell phones? And to go back to the question Your Honor asked earlier, if there's no enabling disclosure for the breadth of the claims, you would be adopting a claim interpretation that would render the claim invalid. So a question would be, if the claim 29, just to pick one, has to have the breadth that 800 ADEPT suggests, and it does have to have that breadth that they're going to accuse us of infringing. If you have to have that, and you interpret it broadly enough to cover real-time calculations, and therefore cell phones, then the fact the specification is not enabling is relevant. Because, and I realize this is frequently a last resort claim interpretation principle, but adopting a claim interpretation would render the claim invalid at the end is not something that the court has been inclined to do. On the other hand, you could adopt the claim interpretation that we have proposed. And let me just say, not only is that claim interpretation consistent with those words, it's consistent with the specification, it's consistent with the last sentence of the abstract, which was added at the very time that all potential parties was added. And if the court considers the specific portions of the file history that distinguish Finicune, they said, as clearly as you could possibly say, here is a system that makes computations in real time. We don't do that. Ours is pre-assigned. This is the situation.
Does Finicune cover cell phones?
Finicune could cover cell phones. It was very early on.
1991.
Yeah, 1991. It was prior art to the 92 filing date. And I'm...
There's no discussion of cell phones in Finicune?
Not that I can recall. Not that I can recall. And, Your Honor...
Let me see if I can simplify this discussion on a cell phone issue. For me, anyway, because I'm simple-minded. I take it what you're arguing is that we need to interpret this patent and the language of the patent claims in the light of the actual invention. And what you're saying is he didn't invent a cell phone mechanism. He talked about it as something that might happen in the future, but that isn't really what his invention is. Is that your argument?
Yes.
And that what you're saying is we need to construe the language of the relevant of the asserted claims in the light of what we could understand as the actual invention. I think that that's basically the case that you're trying to make.
That is the essence of our argument, and the only thing I would add is the invention of the Neville patents as they described it themselves. So it's not from a third part.
Now, help me with one slightly different issue, which is you make the point, and I want to discuss this with your colleague on the other side too, you make the point that if we adopt your understanding of what assigning means, then you don't infringe.
Correct.
Why is that?
Your Honor, because our system makes computations in real time, so there's not a pre-assignment. It has, today, a major advantage because you haven't taken database A and pre-assigned it to database B. And as Your Honor can imagine, on any given day, for telephone numbers, phone numbers get added, phone numbers get deleted, people move, it gives a degree of flexibility that didn't exist before.
Would your system accommodate cell phones?
It could. It doesn't, but it could. You could make the technology that's developing today work with it. You know, the technology that's described in Column 6 as Lorraine, which isn't going to work with either of the systems. But we could make it work with cell phones.
I think you're talking about phasing out the RAM, so I don't know what that has to do with very much. Yes.
Yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with whether it's enabled or not. I think the precise appellate answer to your question is this. If the court consider, the argument is made in 800 in depth brief that if our claim interpretation is correct, there still was proof that we actually pre-assigned numbers.
This is what I'm trying to do.
And, Your Honor, I have gone through each of those. The record is voluminous. I've gone through each of the places that are cited by 800 to death. And very quickly, since I'm over my time, the pages are 5314, 5318 to 5320, 5027, 14946 to 7, 13399, and 6265. Every single one of those citations, which are offered to you for the proposition that we pre-assigned, demonstrate that we don't. They actually prove the contrary. So I think the answer, the precise answer to Your Honor's question is, yes, our argument is that if you look at what the patentee said in the abstract, the specification, the file history, and the claims, this is the correct interpretation. And that correct interpretation can be applied to cell phones, maybe without maximum utility of the system, but it can be applied. And
by using the billing address?
Yes. Or just using the area code. You could use, you know, when you buy a cell phone, you get an area code. You could use that as a starting point.
But you couldn't look at the area code as if you wanted to that.
But the area code could be used to identify a longitude and latitude. If you buy a cell phone, it comes with a three-digit area code, so that could be used. Is it, Judge Dyke, optimal? No. Do they describe a way to enablement? No. I would urge the court that the bottom line question is, should the court take a claim that may or may not be enabled, which there is approximately six lines in the specification, which could work with a cell phone that had an error code, and say, okay, because of that portion of the spec, we will not credit the fact that all the embodiments are consistent with what we say, and all of the statements in the prior art to distinguish the prior art are consistent with the interpretation that we offer. I'm sorry, Judge. Yes.
I'm between two very simple individuals. I just had one question, Mr. Lee. With respect to the changes made by the judge in his jury instruction, were there any objections at that point?
Yes. And I think that the fair characterization is this. If Your Honor considers the pages that are recited where the change is made, there's a very vociferous objection. And the objection that's made, I think the claim interpretation the judge finally offered is actually susceptible of two different interpretations. One would be ours. One would be the broader interpretation. That would be error in of itself, particularly because in the closing arguments, 800 to death adopted the broader interpretation and the court closing argument said that cut their legs out from under them. There is an objection made to that. It's specifically made not only to the change, but also because it would now cover real time. And if I'm recalling the pages correctly, there is a colloquy I think the court will find. All systems require some form of calculations. Even a fixed database system as described in the embodiments. The question is, are you doing calculations through the assignment to a second location in real time?
But your objection, though, that language is his last sentence, however, the 111 patent, 689 patents do not exclude calculations made during the telephone call. That's correct.
Yeah, Your Honor, that's why I say it's susceptible of two interpretations, and what I would ask the court to consider, and let me just get to the precise place. If the court considers the argument that's made at 2458, 24531, this is where 800 adept closes by saying, this claim construction now covers calculations to do the assigning in real time. This has cut the legs out of the position that Tarix has offered you during the trial. So Your Honor is correct. You know, you could take what Judge Lively said, and it's susceptible of a narrow interpretation and a broader one. 800 of that closed and went to the jury on the broader one. The fact that it's susceptible to two, and the jury was allowed to pick one of the two, is in and of itself error of use.
But did you request an instruction that would have precluded calculations as the location after the call?
We at the very place where this colloquy occurred, Your Honor, you will see that we objected to that change in claim construction. Yes.
But did you suggest an alternative?
Yeah, the alternative was to leave it as it was without the addition of the sentence. Because if you left it as it was without the addition of the sentence, then it would not cover real time. And that's the argument that was made. And if the court considers the pages where that change was made, what the district court judge actually said, quite candidly, is, I'm a little uncomfortable with patent cases in this case. If I don't make the change, the plaintiff loses. They won't get to put on their case. Well, and I understand how someone who was newer to patent law would perhaps get a little uncomfortable with that, but that's what happens with claim construction. The court frequently decides claim construction as an issue of law, and one party wins or loses. But if you take the claim construction as it existed, up until that 19th day, that first sentence would do it. And I think, Judge Dyke, the confirmation is, if I could draw the court's attention to page 593.4 of the record appendix, this is 800 a debt. In this case, in the summary judgment proceedings, talking about the five-step process, and I quote, the assigning step must occur before the call comes into the platform. That was not just our position, that was their position. The court adopted a claim construction consistent with it. It was the right claim construction, and it continued to be until the 19th day. An additional sentence was added about calculations that could occur.
Let me just be sure I follow that. If you say they agreed up until that 19th day, wouldn't that have foreclosed their case?
Well,
I don't understand what you're saying.
Under our claim interpretation, they had made representations that our claim interpretation would be accurate. When you got to the 19th day...
They had made representations that your claim construction would be accurate?
They had... I'll be more precise.
I'm not really trying to pin them down as to whether they actually made that representation. But assuming they agreed that your original claim construction was correct, wouldn't that have foreclosed their ability to win under the facts of the case?
Yeah, it should have. But I think, Your Honor, what I'm saying, to try to be more precise, they describe the claims in a way that is consistent with our claim interpretation. Then we got into the trial, and the question became, what kind of calculations could occur during the process? And would those calculations satisfy the assigning limitations? And that's what occurred in mid-trial. And I think what Judge Garrison was referring to is the addition of one sentence. And the addition of that one sentence is critical, we suggest, because that is the sentence that allowed 800 adept to say, see, the legs have been cut out from under.
Okay?
Thank you.
We'll restore your reply time, Mr. Lee.
Thank you.
We'll have the same amount of time for the appellee.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court,
Steve. If you need.
Steve Milbrath.
I'm sure you will.
Steve Milbrath on behalf of 800 to Death. Let me correct a couple of things first. The word pre-assigned does not appear in the patent. Counsel used pre-assigned. The word billing address does not appear in either of the Neville patents. You won't find it. Counsel has misrepresented Judge Foss's Markman. Take a look at it.
I don't think that kind of language is useful. Accuse people of misrepresenting.
I'm saying intentionally, I'm saying, but what he has said is totally inconsistent with what Judge Fawcett ruled. If you look at page 1926 and following the appendix, you'll see she wrote a very detailed opinion. She adopted our claim construction, and that opinion unequivocally states, Your Honor, which counsel has led the court to believe otherwise, that the assigning step does not exclude online calculations. That phrase comes from...
So that's how you think the jury was instructed.
Well, the jury was instructed consistent with the earlier Markman order. It is true that Judge Foss left... If I may, the sequence was, the Markman order was thoroughly consistent with the instruction in that she said, online calculations are not excluded.
But forget about the development.
Thank you.
When the jury was ultimately charged,
yes,
do you agree that they were charged that they could find infringement even though calculations were made after the call was initiated? Calculations of physical location.
The jury was instructed that that the assigning step does not exclude online calculations. Judge Foss was very careful about how she phrased that. She simply said, I'm not excluding online calculations from the step of assigning. Let me explain why she was correct.
Before you do, help me at least understand what is understood by online calculations in that sentence. What are you talking about?
Mark, I'm glad you asked that. I want to urge the court, you don't look at any other part of the record after this oral argument. Go back and look at the Tarvis User's Manual at page 13375.
Speak up, counsel. So
yes, sir. Tarvis User's Manual, page 13375, following. Very, very important. Undermines what you're hearing from counsel today, because what that shows is that a client uses the Tarvis tools to assign before the call every location. It's called the client specific mapping requirement at page 13404. It shows how you point and click a radial territory or a polygon, and you encompass within that territory all of the caller location phone numbers within that territory.
Ahead of time.
Ahead of time.
But that sounds more like you're arguing that they infringe based on their own construction. The argument that I'm trying to get to is, why does it help you to have something that says the patents do not exclude calculations? What kind of calculations are we talking about?
Let's look at Claim 29 specifically. Let me answer that question in that context. There are two limitations. The assignment step in Claim 29, which I quote only in part, assigning to the physical location of said potential parties a telephone number of a service location of a second party that will receive calls looking towards a future event. Now, the last element of that claim is directly routing said telephone call to a service location of a second party assigned, past tense, to said originating telephone number of the first party by said step of assignment. Where in that claim is there any requirement of a particular calculation or a particular algorithm?
I'm having trouble understanding what you're saying.
Okay.
This is Judge Plagg. Let me see if you can answer my question. Is this patent infringed by making online calculations?
That is my point, Your Honor. And I.
Well, yes or no?
May I?
You can just answer yes or no, and then you can explain.
Online calculations is not claimed in Claim 29. The claim doesn't have a limitation.
It's not infringed by online calculations.
If you practice the claim, you infringe.
What's the answer to my question? Infringed by online calculations?
What I'm trying to say is online calculations are simply the routing instructions necessary for the particular database that is used in the application.
Can you answer my question?
Claim 29 doesn't.
Answer my question. Is it answerable?
No, it isn't the way you put it, Your Honor. And this is why. Claim 29, all the assigning limitations do not have a limitation on calculations. Counsel is attempting to import into the claim a limitation that is not there.
I don't understand how you cannot answer my question. The whole case, as it's briefed here,
yes,
is whether the patent is infringed by online calculations or not. Is it your position that making online calculations infringes the patent?
It is our position that you can't practice a patent without some form of calculation. Therefore, when the caller comes online and a calculation is used to retrieve an already assigned dealer record that's already been mapped that is infringement, but the calculation itself is not a limitation in the claim. Again, I say, counsel is attempting to import a limitation that is not present.
Is the patent infringed if the determination of location is made online?
If the determination of location is made online and there has been no assignment beforehand, then you have no way to route the call. That is precisely my point. You must have an assignment before the call in order to
locate.
Let's
assume there's an assignment before the call is initiated by having various kinds of tables built into some platform or some computer somewhere.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, sir.
And then the initiating call comes in.
To the platform.
To the platform.
Some calculation has to be done. Now, does
what calculation has to be done? That's what I'm trying to find out. What is this calculation? See, look, you may have been able to persuade the jury that a statement that the patents do not exclude calculations is a meaningful phrase, but it isn't. Because the question is whether it includes calculations.
And what I'm trying to say.
And we're trying to understand whether it does. Judge Dyke has asked you a very direct question. Is it that it is, if the call includes calculations, does it infringe the double patent?
And my question is, it does infringe if those calculations are used to retrieve a dealer record already mapped out in advance, already assigned, because it's the assigning limitation that we're talking about. There is no online calculation limitation in this patent.
Then what was the judge talking about when she says, at your instance, well, it doesn't exclude calculations.
Because they were
what calculations is it she's contemplating?
Because throughout the trial, from day one, from opening statement forward, Tarvis took a position that Mr. Neville had, in the prosecution of the case, disclaimed any use of online calculations. Now, that absolutely was not what Judge Fawcett ruled, and yet he persisted throughout the trial. And Judge Fawcett agreed with our position because counsel was essentially arguing with the court's claim construction that the phrase from her previous order needed to be added to the jury instruction.
But Mr. Gilbert, when she originally made the definition of claim construction, no such real-time calculation was made to assign it, was it? You agreed to the assigning definition made in the original Markman order?
I think both sides agreed at this part of the Markman instruction, and that is that an assignment is a designation made prior to a telephone call. And we certainly agree to that, because that assignment must be made. And that's why I say, please look at the user's manual, because they do that. They assign. The patent doesn't have a limitation directed to any particular form of calculation.
They assign what? What are they assigning?
They assign the dealer telephone number to the location of the caller, precisely as the
claim. In advance.
In advance.
It's all done.
It's all mapped. That's why it's called a client mapping requirement.
And all that happens is the caller picks up the phone and the system checks the tables and connects the call.
Exactly, Your Honor. That will return the same phone number on the same condition. Let's say you call every time at 9 o'clock. It will always return that dealer. If it's closed, maybe it'll return a different dealer. But the way the tables are constructed, it will always return the same value because they pick the client dealer for that location of the caller in advance. That's the only way their system works. It literally infringes the assigning limitation. The whole notion about calculation, I suggest to you, is an effort to import a limitation.
Do you object to the Markman determination made by the judge for not including real-time calculations?
The judge didn't rule that real-time calculations are not included. The judge ruled, specifically in her order, Your Honor, she ruled that real-time calculations were not excluded.
No, that was in the jury instruction.
That's also in the judge's order. That's why I got a little excited about counsel's representation. We simply look at the judge's order. Page 1926 of the appendix and following, there's a very detailed order where she says, well, there's no disclaimer of real-time calculations in this file history, and whatever is in this file history is ambiguous at best. And moreover, what she said is, Neville's statements are directed to the step of assigning. And that's precisely what I've perhaps inartfully been trying to convey
to you today. What you're suggesting here that what's really involved is not a claim construction issue, but an issue of fact as to whether under the jointly agreed according to you claim construction there was infringement. In other words, you're saying that they assign the numbers before the call is made.
They do. All they agree. All they do.
So you're saying that it does. This doesn't depend on construing the claims to cover assignment of the numbers to a physical location after the call is made. Is that correct?
Well, in this sense, if you don't know where the destination is, how do you assign it when the call is on the
plane?
Counsel. Let me call you on this one.
Yes.
You're shifting the argument, as Judge Dyke, I think, perceived, and is now troubling me. Are you arguing that the way Targus works is to infringe the Neville patent?
Yes.
Even if the Neville patent is understood as was first interpreted under the claim construction before the additional sentence was added. Is that your argument?
That sentence was not added. It was in the original order, and that's where I...
Don't digress on that one. Before the second sentence, the however sentence was added,
yes,
the original assigning was interpreted to mean a designation made prior to the telephone call of the first party.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Are you arguing now that that's fine because Targus's accused system infringed the Neville patent at that point?
It does.
Is that what you're saying?
And what I'm saying is there is no claim limitation as to what happens online. That is the very important point, Your Honor, and I'm sorry to keep laboring, but it's very important that you understand. There is no limitation in this patent as to what procedures you use to execute an assignment that you've already made.
So let me see if I understand. You're saying infringement occurs because of an assignment of a number that occurs before the call takes place.
Yes.
You basically don't care what happens after the call takes place, and you say that the patent doesn't care after what happens after the call.
The patent doesn't have a limitation, and this is why, because it's drawn to any form
Wait. You're saying that the patent is infringed because of the assignment of numbers that they make before the call takes place.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes, I am saying that.
Okay. Is that all you're saying?
No. I'm saying that something has to occur online, but that is not claimed, and the reason it's not claimed is because...
So that doesn't have anything to do with the infringement. Your theory is that the infringement occurs because they assign numbers before the call is made.
And they're retrieving that assigned number...
Right, after the call is made.
Correct. And that's the only way, Your Honor. Ask yourself this. How does Targus get the correct dealer as opposed to an incorrect dealer? The only way they can get the correct dealer, Your Honor, is to have assigned it, mapped it in advance. When the call comes to the platform, there has to be a process, some algorithmic process, to locate the record of the assigned, if you will, dealer. They have to do that. The patent doesn't place any limitations on how you accomplish that. And precisely why is because Mr. Neville discloses a preferred telephone-to-telephone number table. He discloses a relational database. He discloses a hierarchical database. And because he doesn't attempt to limit the number of tables or the form of the database, he necessarily doesn't attempt to limit the algorithms that would be used to make that implementation. In fact, I would urge you to look at
Well, let's stay with the claim for a moment. Claim 29, as I understood it, the allocation of latitude and longitude coordinates of the physical location of all potential first parties. That's a first step. Is that the allocation?
Yes, Your Honor.
First parties?
Yes.
Done geographically?
Yes, that's done geographically.
And then the assigning step comes up to the physical location of potential first parties, a telephone number. So you already have the physical location of the entry telephone, and you match that up with a second telephone location.
In the sense that you already have the lat-long coordinates of all potential callers, remember that Neville assigned the lat-long coordinate to every potential caller, even those that are unknown. Then he determines the client's criteria for defining the boundaries, just like TARDIS discloses that they do. So once
the second step,
the second step is defining the boundaries. What is the area that you want? What is your service area? That's what you ask the client. And when you know what the client's service area is, then you are correlating, to use a word Mr. Neville uses in the prosecution and also in some of the claims, you are correlating the location of a caller and the location of the dealer. And at column 10, lines 4 through 10, Mr. Neville discloses a visual representation of that. I think it's somewhat useful. He says, when the advertiser supplies the designated response zone, that zone is like a transparent layer to the base map containing the phone numbers. So you have a map of phone numbers, and this is precisely how both parties do it. Since they have a computer that has a little dot for every phone number, and you have a territory superimposed on that area.
But now, you don't do that until call comes in.
Oh no, you do that before. You're mapping out.
Their system doesn't do it until the call comes in.
If you look at their user's manual, which is why I say it's so very important, what they say is that you do the same thing Neville does. You draw a radius on a map around the location where you want those phone numbers to go. And you do a polygon, literally a polygon on a map, and every phone number, including those that are unknown, every phone number of a location within that area will be assigned and is assigned automatically.
Before the call.
Before the call. That's exactly what
they're doing. So you agree then that now, if I understand correctly, during the prosecution history, you disclaimed the coverage of an assignment that takes place after the call is placed.
We didn't disclaim calculations. We said that we do our assignment.
You disclaimed that. You agree with that.
I resist the term disclaimer because the patent, the plain language of the claim, would require that.
I'm trying to understand what you're arguing. You can argue whatever you want,
okay,
but you can't be unclear about it.
I'm trying to be clear. Let me say it again. Claim 29 is an example. Does not have a step.
What was disclaimed, what was given up during the prosecution? Did you give up during the prosecution an assignment of number to a physical location that takes place after the call was made?
That, the only context in which I can answer that is in the Finucane context. In the Finucane patent at column 11, I am answering your question with respect to Your Honor. I have to answer it this way. And that is that in the Finucane patent, column 11, there is a random selection of dealer territories. Now that would be an example of a truly on-the-call, on-the-fly, if you will, selection. Mr. Neville said, well, I don't do that. So if that's the only thing, the only point in which there would be a disclaimer is when he's saying, in the context of Finucane, I don't do that type of calculation because I'm correlating the caller and the dealer location in advance, and I'm building the tables accordingly so that when the call comes in, I'm able to write precisely, to route precisely even to down to the street level.
You just touched on something that's been I'm puzzled about. This system would work the same way or differently if we're talking about picking one of the 11 Starbucks within a 3-mile radius of this port. If I call up 1-800-STARBUCKS and I want to ask a question hypothetically, or place an order hypothetically,
yes.
Does your system work in such a way that it would identify a street number precisely? Contrast that, for example, I live out in the country. If I want to call Lowe's Lumber, they know there's one in Easton and there's also one in Annapolis. Easton would be quite closer. The machine presumably would find Easton for me, is that right? But that's an easy pick because they can have a circle 100 miles around the Easton Lowe's. We don't even have a Starbucks, but we're getting one. So it seems to me that there's two very different problems. Are you saying that they work exactly the same way under your...
In the Neville patent, you have street level accuracy because you have lat long coordinates of the street address of the potential caller, or you can have a larger area, of course, like the zip 4 centroid would be one way to disclose in the Neville patent.
And not use lat long.
Well, you're still using lat long. You're saying, let's define a street length by latitude and longitude coordinates. Now let's find the center, thus the word centroid, of that location, and that will be the location of all the callers encompassed within that zip footprint, if you will. And both Neville and Targus have that level of accuracy. The reason they do is this Targus literally infringes.
But your setup is one in which all of that is done in advance, is that right?
It is all done in advance in the sense that
when I pick up my phone, there's no calculations to be done. There's only a lookup and then a connection.
All right, let's talk about the term. Let's talk about the term calculation.
That's what I've been trying to get.
All right, the term calculation, Your Honor. A calculation can be a series of table lookups to locate a record, and the evidence in the record, which we cited in our brief, was that may involve as many as 20 steps by the computer to locate that record.
So a lookup,
everybody has to make some kind of calculation.
So a lookup is a calculation.
And so is a distance calculation. If you've already worked out in advance your radius, and you've already assigned every phone number in that radius, You can say you're doing a distance calculation online, but you're not. You are retrieving a record that you've assigned in advance. That is a calculation. So the point polygon calculator, so-called spatial calculation, point polygon calculation is simply retrieving a record that's already been mapped. That's the only way Targus is able to guarantee a franchise territory will receive only and precisely the calls within that territory. How could it do that on the fly? It has to map that out.
Okay, so let me ask the question. The sole issue, according to you, for us to decide on this appeal, is whether Targus engages in this assignment before the call is made.
Well, that's the only issue on the assignment argument, and they do, we believe that we have proven that they do assign before the call, because all that's happening in the computer, I would urge you to look at the testimony of our expert on this, most of which is unrebutted, and they have very little cross-examination about this point. He describes how they build the tables in advance. They map out the location of the callers, the location of the dealer, and they use an algorithm only to retrieve a record that will always, mathematically certain, unlike Finucane, will always be retrieved.
That's still a calculation.
It's a calculation, and calculation is neither disclaimed in the patent nor limited in any claim in the patent. And I suggest to you, none of the assigning limitations in the patent is there a claim with respect to calculation. Why is that important? Because Mr. Neville's patent was directed to all forms of databases. So he leaves it up to one of ordinary skill to select the procedures online that one would use for that implementation. Mr. Neville also discloses.
But doesn't it also have a pre-assignment to the telephone numbers? If my telephone number would already be pre-assigned within the system by location.
If your phone number is known, if your phone number is known.
Let's say I call Domino's from my home and it's a 202 number. That number is already located within your database.
Yes, and in Targus's. And in Targus's.
Where is it in Targus?
Targus has a master table. Targus has a master table of 10-digit phone numbers. It also has a default. If the number is not in the master table, 10-digit phone numbers, it uses, just like Neville does, a default location. Theirs is a little bit different than Neville's. Their default location is they assume that the central office switch within an exchange is the location of a caller. Now that's obviously
mapped.
Are
you talking about the service location number or the call?
I'm talking about the caller. Let's suppose somebody is calling from a landline. They just moved in, and for whatever reason, Targus doesn't have that phone number. What do you do with that call? Well, Targus has a default assigned in advance in that database that says, okay, we can't find this guy in the master table. We will assume that the default location within the area, within the exchange, and using the lat-long coordinates of the switch, is the location of the caller, and we will then.
So you use the NVA NXX as the,
correct,
as the lat-long location.
And Mr. Neville discloses predominance. Predominance is a feature of Neville. And that enables both parties to have all potential callers. That's exactly what Targus is. So Targus has all potential callers by 10 digits or a default. It has a lat long coordinates of those callers. So now you know
that's
the location.
What causes infringement of the patent. It's not your difference between Mr. Lee. It's not a difference over claim construction. As I understand what you're saying, it's a difference about what the facts are. It's a difference about whether Targus pre-assigns the numbers before the call is made. Right?
Yes, in part. Yes.
Well, what in part not?
Well, because I suggest, Your Honor, that respectfully, that he is attempting to import a limitation that does not exist. And what he wants to do is he wants to import a limitation that says, oh, you can only do lookups, or you can only do X or Y. And his position has been very, or his client's position has been very consistent. On the one hand, they said, you can't do any calculations. Well, they knew that wouldn't work, and even their expert wouldn't support that. Then they said, well, you can do anything but spatial calculations. And in the reply brief in this court, they're now taking the position that we're limited to a lookup. Limited to a lookup. Nothing else.
And well, you're saying the Neville patent doesn't address that question, and therefore it's not excluded.
Correct. It doesn't address it. It addresses it in this sense. The Neville patent repeatedly discloses. You find out the format. Consider, for example, column 12 of the Neville, of the 111 patent. It says you find the format that the LDC wishes to receive the routing information. You deliver the phone number and the downlines in the desired format, and then you submit direct routing instructions, and then you submit what other additional direct routing instructions. Now, the evidence was one of ordinary skill would understand that those are the stored procedures necessary for the implementation of the database.
Mr. Milbrook, why don't you just finish your thought? We've already allowed you a lot more time than we initially intended, but go ahead and finish it up. One sentence.
We would suggest Judge Voss's opinion very thoroughly makes these points, and she correctly shows why there is no disclaimer of online calculations, and there is no limitation to an online calculation. Fergus's entire position lost at trial because the jury found that they infringed consistent with a valid instruction. And therefore, there is no merit to this appeal.
That's a full paragraph. Mr. Lee, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have 4 points to make.
So presumably, one of them will be to address their contention that this is really a factual issue and that you, the parties, pre-assigned the numbers to the court.
The answer is that's not what the record says. All the record citations. Yes, the answer is that's one of the four, and I'll address it first. That's not what the record says. That's not what the proof is. And there's nothing to sustain that position. In fact, Your Honor, in the portion of the Targus user manual they cited, Your Honor, to, if Your Honor, the court continues to page 13399.
Which volume is that?
I can't really not sure, Your Honor. But it's 13399. I actually can't answer myself, prepare myself. But what the user manual
says.
Do you
bring all 17 volumes with you?
We apologize for the length of the appendix.
Some of the pages are out of order.
Yeah. About 5% of it is what we've cited in our brief. But to go to the point, Your Honor, 13399 says that in Targus's system, the service location telephone numbers are, and I quote, determined on the fly with each telephone call. And I think I can sort through what was offered to Your Honor to the court here. For sure, you're going to have a database of telephone numbers of users. For sure, you're going to have a database of locations. The difference between the two is it's not just assigning in the abstract. It's assigning a telephone number of a service location. So to take Judge Plager's example, when you call from the district, you're assigned to one of the 12. In our system, you are not. There are possible, you could be assigned to any one of the 12, and one of the advances that our system makes is, if I were to take 12 pizza parlors within the district, you can put criteria in that says, route my call to one that makes delivery.
Yeah, to one that...
To a Domino's place that makes delivery, or a pizza shop that makes delivery, and you'll be routed to a different telephone number. So what counsel has
that
said...
That can be done in advance, because they know in advance who delivers.
You could do it in advance, and if you did it in advance, you might be fall within the scope of the claim. But we don't do it in advance. And it's that flexibility that allows...
Well, that's what flexibility has to do with whether you're infringing. Maybe that you're able to do things through the flexibility of your system that the Neville patent didn't come. But that seems to me not particularly pertinent. The question is whether you, in fact, are also doing what the Neville patent describes.
And the answer is...
They say, yes, you are, because you are assigning the physical location before the call is made.
And the answer is, Your Honor, we're not. And to give you an idea, the portions that they refer Your Honor to in the appendix, for instance, are the testimony of their own expert who says at page 5027, the Targus system, quote, does some type of online calculation to choose the appropriate one once the call has been made.
What does
that's
that
your own expert.
What does that mean?
That means, Your Honor, that when the call, your call comes in and there are 12 different possible locations, rather than having you assigned to one, to number two automatically, which is what's disclosed in the spec, our system would allow you to, depending on the parameters you put in, right, pick one of the 12. So you might pick the one that's closest. You might pick the one that has a place to sit down. You might pick the one that has internet service. And then our system says, okay, with those parameters, you could route it to a different one. And Judge Dyke, that's why, to go to your question, it does matter because we are not pre-assigning for a reason. The flexibility comes from not pre-assigning.
Does that mean you're going to keep changing the criteria? Is that what you're saying?
It allows the database folks to change the criteria, yes. And that's one of the reasons that the system doesn't pre-assign.
But it seems to me that doesn't necessarily preclude infringement. If you have a situation in which you pre-assign the number of physical locations, but when the call is made, changes could be made in the assignment because of various parameters. One location's busy, another one's not. One provides the kind of delivery that they want, right, but the other one doesn't. It seems to me that that doesn't preclude infringement, that you have that kind of flexibility to change the assignment after the call is made. The question is whether there is an assignment to a physical location before the call is made, even if it may be changed afterwards.
And Your Honor, the best I can do is refer you to the portion of the appendix I cited, Your Honor, that doesn't occur in our system. And
you're saying that the assignment doesn't occur because there are possible additional calculations.
Right. And let me go, that covers the second and third points.
So
there is a difference.
Before you go on the second,
sure.
Is there, in the TARDIS system, is there an assignment that takes place before the call is made? The assignment to a physical location.
Is your assignment to a second, to a physical location of one of the Starbucks? No.
And that's because of the way you define the term assignment, which gets us back to the claim construction problem.
Yes. And yes, good player. And to go to it, what's key is it's not just assignment in the abstract, it's assigning a telephone number of a service location of a second party. So, Judge Dyke, the question would be, do we assign the service location of a second party in our system before the call comes in? And the answer to that is no.
If you substitute the word A for the word B, it's the same thing true. In other words, that you don't assign A physical location before the
right,
call?
That's right. We wait till the call comes in. And that, if that answers the question, that goes to the question of these calculations and what they said in the file history. They were very careful. They referred to the different type of calculations. And at 8572, if I could just quote briefly, they say the prior art has a computer that performs point of origin to point of termination calculations while the caller is on the line. Point of origin is Judge Click. Point of termination is which Starbucks. Applicants' direct routing telephone systems performs all such calculations prior to the call even being made, and in fact prior to delivery of the database to the long distance carrier. So they have distinguished a system.
What are you reading from that?
This is their statement distinguishing the prior art from the prosecution history at 8572. And they made the same statement at 8626, where they say, and this is a quote, "The present invention eliminates the need to perform online calculations to determine the appropriate terminating
now
number."
All that was given to the judge and the jury. There's one small problem in your position, which is you've got a big jury verdict against you.
We do have a big jury verdict against us.
How could all this happen?
Well, you know, Your Honor, there are a series of events that occurred. And I'm not sure. I wasn't there. Counsel was. But I think if Your Honor considers the portion of the transcript where the judge decides to add this portion of the claim interpretation that we're focusing on, you will see that she says, "I'm just uncomfortable here. I'm not sure what the right thing to do is. I'm going to adopt an interpretation that lets the plaintiffs prove their case." And that's what they did, because the question that Judge Dyke asked counsel at the outset of the argument, they actually explicitly answered. The question, this whole question of the last sentence that Judge Garrison referred me to earlier, this is what they said to the jury. And that's why the question is, I think, Judge Dyke, broader than just could you search the record and find one sentence that might support infringement under our claim interpretation? I think if you got there and then you balanced it against what was said to the jury, we would at least get a new trial. Because here's what they said that explicitly answers your question. Now, this is at 2452. Now, the court has instructed you, because the defendants have claimed that the patent, the Neville patent, does not disclose online calculations or calculations made while the person is on the phone. Dave Targus has been telling you that. Well, they told you that and told the judge instructed you, which says in page 6 of your jury instructions, the definition of assigning, it says, then they read the second sentence. Folks, they're going to come up and have some sort of explanation for that, but that just cut their legs right out from under them. So this is a...
But that's completely ambiguous. I mean, what you mean by calculations.
But, Your Honor...
There are some kinds of calculations that are made after the call is made, which everybody apparently does. The question is whether you pre-assign these numbers according to the claim before the call is made, regardless of what you do after the call is made.
And I agree. And that's what is described in the prosecution history. That's what they say is different. And that's what the proof demonstrates we do not do. I was trying to answer Your Honor's question of, is just the narrow question, is there some proof that would indicate, is there some evidence, even contradicted, that would demonstrate that we, Targus, pre-assigns a telephone number? The answer, I suggest, is no, and best I can do is refer the court to the record site. But if Your Honor considers the arguments made in their entirety, they weren't arguing ambiguity. They were arguing that what Targus does to assign a telephone number after the call comes in infringes this patent. That's, Your Honor, why the fight was about claim construction on the 19th day of trial. It wasn't a coincidence.
Mr. Lee, one final sentence to do it.
Your Honor, I have actually nothing further, so that'll be my final sentence.
That's a good final sentence.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.